Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 287 of the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Adam, joined by Jill. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. It's the Monday after Thanksgiving. And yeah.
We're kind of cheating.
We are. In fact, when you were like, this is going to be episode 287, I was like, well, it's only kind of going to be 287.
So we decided because it's the Monday after Thanksgiving and we are off for the week and not going to have time, that we're going to give you guys sort of like a refresh of an older episode.
Yeah. And this is the cool, like, we've interviewed so many amazing people, but this is the actual coolest thing we've ever done. So
correct.
And new-ish listeners, and it could be even honest, like the last 2 years at this point.
Yep.
So not new listeners. If you're a long-time listener, but you've only been listening for 2 years, you may not have known that we interviewed Alan Cumming live at our local library in front of like 600 of our closest friends.
Yes, we did.
So we're going to let you re-listen to that. Is there anything else you want to talk? I mean, I think you're going to leave the intro from the other one so you can get more reason. He wrote books. You'll hear about them.
Yeah. So, hope everyone's having a good Monday. And you can visit our website, professionalbooknerds.com. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds, and you can email us at ProfessionalBookNerds@Overdrive.com. If you listened to our Thursday episode, you know that, for the next couple weeks, if you want to get some book recommendations for you or for someone you need to give a book gift to, feel free to reach out to us, and we'll hopefully be able to do an episode coming up with some gift-giving book recommendations for listeners.
Yeah.
I think that's everything.
I got nothing else.
Okay. Well, I hope you guys enjoy this re-listen to an earlier episode of the Professional Book Nerds with Alan Cumming. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 73rd episode of the Professional Book Nerds podcast.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
To us.
Well, to the podcast.
To the podcast. It's neither of our actual birthdays.
It is not. That would be weird if it was.
Yeah, if our 1 year anniversary of the podcast was on an actual birthday, that'd be great.
No.
So what happened for this episode, Jill?
I don't know. Not much.
Not a big deal. Not a whole lot. We interviewed Alan Cumming.
Yeah, we did.
The legend, Alan, the best person on earth, Alan Cumming, I think. He certainly has one of the best voices.
Yeah.
He's just a wonderful person, and we got there and he was in the middle of signing 400 books.
Yes, he was.
And because he didn't have time to stay after, because he had to go do a show at Playhouse Square.
He had to go sing songs.
He had to go sing sappy songs. Alan Cumming sings sappy songs. That is his cabaret style show. So he couldn't stay after, so he had to do that beforehand. And then we chatted for an hour. Words are hard. We chatted with him for an hour about his newest book, which is You've Got to Get Bigger Dreams. We talked about his memoir, which is Not My Father's Son. We talked about how he narrates audiobooks. We talked about him on The Good Wife.
We talked about a lot.
We talked about a lot because he's done so much. So So good. I don't have words to describe how great this was. And we took I'm just going to call it the greatest selfie of all time.
We did. It was a good selfie.
Yeah, with Alan, the two of us, and then 400 of our closest new friends.
Yep.
So if you are looking at this on Libsyn, you will see that. And if you follow us on social media, you probably have seen that already. So, yeah, it was amazing. And this is our big one-year anniversary of the podcast.
Can you believe it?
It's crazy. Over a year ago, you came up to me and you're like, I have an idea for a thing. Why don't we do a podcast?
I know. I was like a brand new employee, too. I think I'd been here for like a month.
Yeah.
I came and I was like, we should have a podcast.
Yeah. And then we sat down and we came up with how we wanted to structure it, which has changed a lot anyway.
Agreed.
And we came up with a name and we pitched it to my director. He said, go for it. And then we recorded a few episodes in rooms that had horrible sound. And
oh, God, they did. It was horrible.
And now we have our own recording studio.
We do.
Which you and I just kind of have taken over as our little private office.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's been a long time. And like you said before, thank you to everyone who stuck with us in the beginning.
Our first episode, I wanted to look this up just to see.
Oh, no.
No, we got like 60 downloads.
60?
On the first day, which is actually pretty good.
For the first day of something, not too shabby.
Yeah, but we've come a long way since then.
Thankfully, we have more than that now.
We have more than that now. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. If we only had 60 downloads now for all these episodes, my director would probably be very mad that we paid a lot of money for all these.
And like half of that was probably Overdrive employees, to be honest.
100%, yeah. So, yeah, without question. And they're probably like us downloading them on different devices and computers. We're feeling happy and nostalgic and all those good things. And we look forward to many, many, many more episodes of providing you guys book recommendations and fun interviews with authors. And yeah, I don't know. Is there other things? I don't know.
No. Thursday is going to be our big Best Books of 2016 episode.
Yes. So we're going to bring back a number of our staff librarians and coworkers who have been on the podcast before and ask them what their favorite books are. We're going to let everyone say their three favorite books because asking someone their favorite book is very difficult, which you'll hear Alan Cumming talk about, that he hates offering up favorite things. And then I proceeded to ask him, our nerd nine, all about his favorite stuff. So, on Thursday, we'll have a bunch of people coming in and telling you guys their favorite books of the year. So give you a nice year-end best of type of a list.
Yep.
And actually, do us a favor. If you have your favorite books, send us an email at feedback@overdrive.com. We'd love to hear what your favorite books are. I'm actually working on creating a Overdrive users' favorite books of the year list on overdrive.com. So I would love to add our podcast listeners in there. So if you send us an email, that would be great. I would love to see those. So, like I said, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and email us and all that good stuff, all that jazz. So, anything else?
No. What about you?
I don't think so. I'm excited. Our holiday party is tonight, so I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, we're recording this on Friday.
Yeah, Overdrive throws a good party. We always
throw a good party.
Yeah, we throw a good party and very, very excited about that. So,
see if any of our library listeners come to GP. DGP. I can't speak today.
It's okay.
DGP. In August, they'll get to find out about the parties.
They are spectacular. So, all right. Well, I was going to sing Cabaret, but we've already done that once, so I'm not going to force people to listen to me do that again. I hope you all enjoy this very special one-year anniversary episode of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast with Alan Cumming.
No doubt you've enjoyed his many films, including Circle of Friends, Emma, and GoldenEye. He also co-wrote, co-directed, and co-starred in Anniversary Party with his friend Jennifer Jason Leigh. His range is truly extraordinary. He has voiced a Smurf, played Hamlet. He's been an X-Men and hosted Masterpiece Theater, the Tonys, and the International Emmy Awards. In 2012, he opened his first photography exhibition, Alan Cumming Snaps. He also found time to introduce an award-winning fragrance called, appropriately enough, Cumming, and a later scent, Second Cumming. In 2014, he published his best-selling memoir, Not My Father's Son. And of course, today we are here to celebrate his latest book, You Gotta Get Bigger Dreams, of which you'll all be getting a copy, as well as his hit one-man show, Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs. And of course, Alan will be also appearing tonight down at Playhouse Square in the Connor Palace at 7:30. So without further ado, please welcome our professional book nerds and true Renaissance man, Mr. Alan Cumming.
Hello.
Hello. That was a lot.
Crowd.
I was worried your intro, we weren't even going to have time to actually ask you any questions. Just, you've done so much.
I'm very old.
All right, so just to kick us off, can you maybe share with people who might not be aware why and what You've Got to Get Bigger Dreams is kind of all about and where the idea came from?
It's a book, first of all. And
it's a good start.
It's a book of stories and photographs that are sort of little... I mean, I like this idea of snapshots. They're snapshots of my life, literally and visually. And it's just a kind of way for me to, you know, tell stories about things that have happened to me, but also do it in a way that's not maybe the conventional way. And I like the idea of doing... I like taking photographs... But I kind of like snapping the essence of a moment rather than taking a beautiful picture mostly, and so I thought this was a good way to kind of combine my photos and also I like it, the idea that it's what a book you can pick up and read one of the stories and put down and then pick it up again, and you know, it's a good on the loo book.
Yeah.
I will admit to reading it all in one sitting, not on the loo. That would have been, but I will admit going all the way through. Yeah. So I will admit I read it all at once. So
that's fine too.
All right.
You wrote your memoir, Not Your Father's Son, and it's such a moving and emotional story. This is a little more of a lighthearted approach to the things in your life. What was sort of the mental transition between writing these two different books?
Well, actually, I sort of started this book before Not My Father's Son. So I've been, some of the stories go way back. Like, well, the first story is about when I got my first camera when I was 10. And then there's a story about Gore Vidal that I wrote shortly after I... spent the time with them that the story's about. So those stories I'd started to do, and then all the stuff that happened to me because that was the catalyst for Not My Father's Son happened. So I kind of postponed, you know, put this book to the side and then wrote that one. So coming back to it was actually a really nice sort of fun kind of thing to do after the sort of intensity of Not My Father's Son. And I felt that I and my readers could do with a bit of a break, you know, lighten up a bit. But the stories are, it's also more about my contemporary life now. And also I wanted to kind of just, you know, do a book about the crazy stuff that I experienced, but also be able to stand outside it and you know, give it the value of crazy that it deserves.
And so You've Got to Get Bigger Dreams. It's obviously a very visual book, but for, you know, Not My Father's Son, we both listen to the audiobook. It's something that I'm a big fan of anytime there's a memoir or an autobiography. Listening to the person actually tell the story is something that makes, I think it brings the story to an entirely another level. And that you're not just doing audiobooks of your own stories. You have a history of doing audiobooks for others as well. So can you maybe just take us through that experience of creating an audiobook version of a title, whether it's for yourself or for another author?
Well, it's I really like it, actually. I really like doing audiobooks because it's just, you know, I sort of think of myself as a storyteller. No matter what I do, that's all I'm doing is really telling stories in different forms. So actually just sitting down and telling a story is like the sort of, you know, apotheosis of that. And so it's quite intense because, you know, if it's a whole unabridged novel, it can take quite a few days. And you're just in a little studio on your own with someone through the glass kind of telling you when you've missed a word or something. when it's, you know, someone else's book, I read the book and... Then just there's lots of different accents and things. You know, you have to kind of do a little bit of preparation. And not once I did a Michael Ondaatje book that was set in Sri Lanka, and there was one page that was just a list of Sri Lankan names of people who'd been murdered in this sort of. I was like, oh my god! One page took me like an hour with all the pronunciations. But for my book, it was my books. It's been interesting because I haven't, you know, I maybe read passages of them aloud, just to my husband or to friends or something. But most, a huge swathe of it, I've never read, you know, aloud before. So it's kind of funny hearing your own story in a different way. And then my first book is a novel I wrote called Tommy's Tale. They re-released that when Not My Father's Son came out. And so, and shortly before that, I did the audiobook. I don't know why I didn't do it when it came out, but it was really kind of funny going back to something after such a long time. And I was reading my own book thinking, gosh, it does end rather suddenly. Yes. I need to get better at structure. And I actually even did an audiobook of Not My Father's, of this one, You've Got to Get Bigger Dreams. So an audiobook with a, when you download it, you get a PDF file with a lot of the pictures on it. So it's kind of an audiovisual book.
I'm just imagining you being like, describing the picture while it's, imagine me sitting with my dog.
Yes.
And his.
Well, sometimes you have to go like, so, and in the picture, which you can download on your PDF, and blah, blah, blah. It's a little laborious, I thought.
That's actually kind of fun. A lot of audiobooks now, especially with memoirs, the actors sort of insert a little bit extra when they do the audiobooks. They don't just straight read the books. They add commentary a little bit.
Oh, do they? Oh, I didn't do that.
It's okay. Next time, you can do
that. The one thing I did, I read the acknowledgments, you know, at the end, that I'd never read them before, and also I'd never kind of, you do the acknowledgments at the very end, you know, just before everything goes to press or print, or whatever you call it nowadays. And that was the hardest part for me, because I hadn't actually ever read that aloud, and what I was saying was much more new and less measured, you know what I mean? Because I sort of said, I forgive my father, and I'd forgotten I'd said that, and I suddenly got all upset in the studio.
So this is a book about your camera, and as an actor, you're used to having cameras on you all the time, and you sort of... I'm imagining.
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do.
Yes,
I know. Do. There's cameras now in the audience.
Yeah, I'd say there's a few in here.
Flashes. As an actor, I'm imagining you sort of pull personal experiences that you use when you act on, you know, when you're acting. With Not My Father's Son, here you are in this very dealing with this personal stuff behind this cameras, but you're filming this reality TV show, trying to not let that come on camera. Like, what was that like?
It was a nightmare. I mean, it's really, really crazy. I mean, this is the thing about my last book, where I was doing this BBC show, Who Do You Think You Are, you know, where they trace your genealogy. And then at the same time as I was filming that, I was dealing with the fact that my father told me I wasn't his biological son. And I was traveling all around the world on this show and trying to, like, do a DNA test with my brother and all these things. It was maddening. I mean, I felt, you know, and having to sort of, my father suddenly was back in my life after 20 years, and I went back to film this thing in South Africa, and it was really, I mean, the craziest, sort of funniest but awful things. The last time I ever spoke to my father, when, you know, when I discovered the results of the DNA test and had to tell him, and I knew this would be the last time I'd ever talk to him, and I said so. I finished the call, put the phone down, I realized I was completely in drag in my trailer. At lunchtime in South Africa, I was being a transvestite. And so I was wearing, like, my wig was off, I had full makeup, a bra, chicken cutlets, and, like, you know, stockings and high heels and everything. I thought, this is absolutely perfect. This really is the icing on a very horribly tasting cake.
So, and not to bounce around a little bit, but we, you know, want to cover as much of your, you know, life and amazing experiences as we have. So with your cabaret-style show, Alan Cummings Sings Sappy Songs. In your most recent title, you talk about a little bit how you had these singing opportunities where you were used to playing characters, and so in your mind, the character could sing. It wasn't Alan Cummings singing. It was the MC singing. And then you had an experience where it was at the Hollywood Bowl that they said, would you like to sing these songs? And you realized it was yourself. You were actually going to be singing as yourself. So... maybe, how, is that where Alan Cummings Sings Happy Songs came from, was kind of realizing that you can do this as well?
Well, yes, sort of. So, I mean, what really happened was that was a long time ago. That's a story in this book about singing at the Hollywood Bowl, because it's just it was the first time I ever sang, you know, as me. It didn't start small. It was at the Hollywood Bowl with a 70-piece orchestra and 18,000 people in the audience, and I was doing it with Ann Miller, the MGM musical legend, and Charlotte Church, voice of an angel, and Leah Delaria, voice of the devil. And so, but it was one of those things that I'd sort of thought, okay, challenge yourself. It was very far in advance. And usually I say things like that, you know, I say, yes, it's fine. It's 9 months' time. I'll get myself ready. And then, you know, a month before, I'm like, what the hell? So I did it. It was only 3 nights. And I just only had to sing like 3 songs. It wasn't that big a deal in terms of my time and everything. But it was a huge deal in terms of that I was just walking out on stage and not, you know, have it singing in a different voice. So then, cut to, I talk about this in my show tonight, actually. In like 2008, I think, the Lincoln Center in New York asked me to, they have this thing called the American Songbook Series, and they asked me to do a concert, 2 concerts. And they sort of, you know, they sort of pay for you to have a show, really. They kind of pay, give you money, then they commission a show, then you have a show, and you can. So I did, in 2009, I did my first cabaret show. It was called I Bought a Blue Car Today. It was about me becoming an American citizen. And, but like, you know, stories and songs, like tonight. And I kind of really, I bit the bullet and really, you know, did it and enjoyed it. I remember, like, when the very first performance, like, the band went on to tune up, and I was left on my own. I was so nervous, like, just, like, totally just shaking, really shaking. And there was a little man, you know, with his headpiece on, a little walkie-talkie thing. And I just said to him, I could run away right now, couldn't I? And nobody would know. And he was just like, he thought, oh my God, I've got a crazy one here. I was this close. And my manager came to my room and said, how are you? And I just went, I want to punch you in the face. That's what I said. I just was so, I felt like something was out of body experience. But then, you know, I got better at it and I got more comfortable with it. And so then this show, which I started last year, Alan Cumming Sings Happy Songs, because I felt I was getting better at it, I made it a more emotional and more kind of, I talk about more personal things, and it's you know, the songs are all quite intense, emotional songs. It's funny and everything still, but I think I've just got better at it. I mean, I'm more comfortable at being vulnerable in terms of myself, and I talk about quite vulnerable things, like my father and a tattoo I had removed and things like that.
We sort of did bounce around questions a little bit because you've done so much, the books, the TV, movies.
My porn career.
That as well. Can't forget that.
That's my new thing. If people that come up to me and they say that thing, I'm going, I know you, but I don't know where from. I always say, do you watch a lot of porn? And then they stop talking to you after that.
Well, maybe that actually answers my next question.
Is there anything I haven't done that I want to do?
No. That's another question. No, just kidding. How would you, if someone came up and asked you, like, what do you do for a living? How would you describe yourself?
Well, normally I just say I'm an actor. But if I was to do it, like, I think at the back of the book, actually, I say I think of myself as a storyteller and a provocateur for hire.
All right. That's good.
Thanks.
Okay, so, and don't let the fact that you're sitting in a library influence this answer at all. But if you could only pick one of your careers, writer, actor, singer, you know, movies, TV, what would you choose?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's so Sophie's Choice, this question. And, you know, it's so, like, unlikely that I'm going to be, you know, someone saying, you've got to choose, Alan! But I think if I did, I mean, I really do. I mean, it would definitely be the theater. It would definitely be being on a stage, whether it's, doing a play or something, or whether it's doing my show, right, like I do right now. Because what's great about this show is that I go all over the world actually and do it, and you get this amazing connection with the audience, and it really sort of sates my need for live performance. But I don't have to do it for 6 months, 8 shows a week. So it's actually a really nice way to kind of keep my toe in or my hand in, whatever you call it. And also it definitely keeps your, it's definitely a workout in terms of performance, because it's just you. I mean, I've got my lovely band, but, you know, it's funny. I was saying the other night, we ate this delicious dinner, but a little too near the curtain time. And so I was so burpy. And there's nowhere to hide when it's just you. And you have to, like, slug water when people are clapping or laughing. And so burping is quite hard to do in a one-man show.
I feel like you could get away with just telling people, like, that's look, right. It's my show. I had a dinner. I'm sorry. You're going to have to deal with this.
I'm going to have to burp now. Yeah.
When we were backstage, you were talking about Margaret Atwood, who's one of my absolute favorite authors. She is, yes. And I know from, following you on Instagram that you're a fan of hers, too.
Yes.
Are there any other authors that you really like and read?
There's a really great author in Scotland called Janice Galloway, and I just always, you know, because of doing books, you have to sometimes write your 10 favorite things. It's always a difficult thing, that, because I don't know about you, but whenever you're asked for your favorite something or other, I can't think of anything I've ever liked. It's just like, and people say, what's your favorite play? Sometimes theaters say, Alan, any play you ever want to do, just come and do it, and I can never think of a play I've ever liked or a character I've ever wanted to play. But Janice Galloway is this amazing Scottish writer, and she's really sort of visceral, and the book that got me going on her was is called The Trick Is to Keep Breathing, and it's about a woman kind of having a breakdown, and it's so brilliant, but you feel like you're inside this person's mind when you're reading it. I mean, it's kind of like a sort of Scottish version of Catcher in the Rye, if you like, you know, a female Scottish version, but also I hate when people do that, when they say it's Catcher in the Rye meets The Assassin, you know. There's mixtures of things, but I really do love her, and I'm always very excited when she has a new book out. And I don't think she's terribly well known here, so I'm always keen to, you know, promote Scottish talent.
Well, we're in a library, so
yes,
lots of readers.
That's perfect time. Yeah. I was say, I feel like I could just see everybody like kind of quickly writing down, like, what did you say?
Janice Galloway.
So Jill and I were joking before we came here today that you've had a number of amazing cameos in different things. Sex and the City, you also basically were in Romeo and Michelle, and we were wondering, do you have a favorite cameo you've ever done, or like a favorite memory from a cameo?
Well, yes. There's a thing that I do, I've done recently, it's a web series called The Outs, and what happened was, someone said, oh, this is a funny web series, it's about these young people in Brooklyn. As a gay couple have split up, and then it's about the girl, the flatmate, and they're just you know, it's kind of like just people trying to get by and just trying to deal with being young adults and love and, you know, everything. And I watched a few episodes of it, and I thought it was really great, and I tweeted that I liked it, and, you know, to try and give it a little boost. And then the guy who wrote it, who's called Adam Goldman, he tweeted back and said, oh, we love you, Alan, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I had lunch with them, and I ended up being in The Outs as myself, playing myself. Which is a sort of a heightened version of me, I have to say, but I basically just make out with people everywhere and kind of. But what was hilarious, I did the first season, and then Vimeo commissioned the second season, and so basically all I do is I go along for a couple of days and I make out with some hot boy in a bar, and everyone does kind of, is that Alan coming? That's Alan coming. That's Alan coming. So that's quite funny, and then once I did a mini series, I just went for a week to do this little part in a miniseries for the Sci-Fi Channel. I was getting divorced at the time, and I needed some money, and it was easy, and it was only a week, and so I went, and it was a great thing, but I didn't. It was one of those scripts. It was so dense and sci-fi, and, you know, full of, you had to really, really focus, and I didn't really have the time to. I just kind of looked at my bits, and I just couldn't really understand the plot at all. So, and I was sort of in this blue kind of, I had a blue face again, and I was in a hood. I was some sort of, you know, intergalactic monk. I wasn't quite sure what was going on. And I did, there was one scene with there's a boy, one of those actors who speaks very, you know, sort of talks like this. Because you can't actually hear what they're saying in the scene, which doesn't really help when you've not got a full grasp of the whole plot yourself. So I was just standing there being a monk, being an intergalactic monk, doing my thing. And then when I saw that, they sent me the thing and sent me some clips of it for the press release thing. And I realized afterwards, they, you know, in post, they'd put, there was like a village between us speaking, there was a village in the background on fire and people running around. And nobody had told me that. And I thought that might have, you know, affected my performance somewhat.
Sure.
But I actually realized when I got on that set, I thought, I don't think any of you understand this either. So everyone was skirting around, the talking about the actual plot.
Okay, so Adam and I are huge Broadway theater nerds. And, of course, Cabaret. What attracts you to that show to keep going back so many times?
Well, I think it's really because it's... it's because it's needed. I think it's a show that's about things that are really important and unfortunately keep being important. And I wish we were doing it again right now, because it's about the need to embrace difference and not to make people who are other from you the enemy. And it's also about the responsibility we have as a society to be vigilant against slow and insidious extremism. And that is exactly what is happening in this country right now. I don't think anyone, even if you did vote for Donald Trump, could not admit that there's a sudden huge change in the fact that there are people who, you know, are supporting white supremacist attitudes in the White House. Mm-hmm. That's a sudden and marked change. And so that's kind of what was happening in the plot of Cabaret. So, I mean, and 2 years ago when we did it again, it was kind of because I felt it was relevant because of stuff that's happening in Russia. And, you know, but it just, sadly, it's such a good, that's why good plays are done again, I suppose. That's why we do the Greeks, you know, they still have lots to tell us. And this show is about something, about the, you know, both those things, the need to embrace difference and the need to be vigilant. And I just think those are lessons we need to keep hearing again and again. So that's really what drew mm-hmm. me to them. To it.
Yes.
So you mentioned you did it 2 years ago, and perhaps the importance of it still being very essential. I'm on record on our podcast telling one of the authors we spoke to, one of the biggest regrets I ever have, I never got to see you do that performance. Would you ever consider doing it again? Not to put you on the spot, but I'm putting you on the spot.
Well, actually, it's got quite funny. The lady I met in the when I was signing the books earlier, she thought she'd seen me in Cleveland, and it wasn't me, someone on tour. Yeah. So actually, it's quite good, the kind of people, you know, when you do a show like that and then people take over, they kind of sometimes, especially that was so sort of an iconic look and it's very sort of me-ish. And so I think a lot of the time, I would even flip through magazines and think, oh, that's me, and it wasn't someone. So it's actually quite good that maybe someone will do it again and people will think it's me and it's not. But so I did it this, you know, 16 years ago I did it, and then I did it last year, and I turned 50 when I was doing it. I know it's hard to believe, but so that would mean if I did it another 16 years, I'd be 66 years old. I think that would be really weird and pervy to see a 66-year-old man in a harness with his crotch. But what I say is, if I do it again next time, I'm going to play Fräulein Schneider instead. I think I could pull it off. She's got some great songs.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to. I'm putting that out there. I quite like a. It's a time for a trans Fräulein Schneider.
Oh, that's funny.
Now that's in my head, just typing permanently. Are there any...
I've got the man bun and everything already.
I was saying, you're starting because the hair's already growing out. Are there any Broadway shows or roles that you would love to play that you haven't yet?
Again, you know, like I said earlier, I just can't. I can never remember anything.
Yeah,
I used to always say King Lear because I thought it was so far in advance. Now it's not that far, you know, as I'm getting older. So I used to say that to shut them up. And now I mean, there's a couple of things that are, you know, bubbling around, but there's nothing that I'm really, you know. And also, I think it's better to be open to things and just see what comes up, because sometimes if you're so set on something, you kind of keep your focus on that, and you kind of lose what might be a possibility around you. Mm-hmm.
So Cabaret, you talked about sort of the message and the necessity of seeing that show, and art in general sort of exemplifies that. Are there other shows that you would recommend sort of tackle issues that are necessary on the same kind of level?
On right now, you mean, that I've seen?
Or just...
Oh, well, I always think, you know, Shakespeare and the Greeks. I did The Bacchae a few years ago by Euripides, and I think those plays... There's a reason why we keep doing them, because they talk about really vital human conflicts and lessons that we need to hear again. And so I would just be in a general way talk about those. Although there is an actual a play that I was in Edinburgh during the festival doing my show, and I went to this theatre. I did a sort of workshop thing, and they had pictures of all the old plays that were there. Was one of me in there in 1986 in this Molière play. It's shocking, but there was this play I saw a still from. It was called Good, and it's by C.P. Taylor. And it kind of was mulling. I wrote it down in my phone, and I came back. And then I got Jimmy in my office to get it for me recently, and we're actually going to do a reading of it next year. And it's so fascinating, because it's about just exactly what I was talking about. I'd seen it once in the 80s, but it's about a man in Germany who slowly, you see him how it just, you know, he's a perfectly level-headed, it's kind of against all the Nazi things to start with. And then through kind of circumstance, cajoling, practicality, pragmatism, he suddenly is a member of the Nazi Party. Mm-hmm. And it's a really, really brilliantly written, and also it really shows you how easy it is for us all to slide into something and to not really realize how far we've gone. And that's this, again, this need to be vigilant. So that's a play that I'm, it's not necessarily the role that I'm, you know, but I'm actually, there was something about it that I realized I was drawn to again. And then when I read it, I remembered why. So things like that, that kind of just remind us of lessons we should have learned in the past, and we've got to, you know, right, be vigilant again. That's really where I'm at right now.
Yeah, no.
Okay. Well, we want to let some of the audience members ask some questions here, but before we do that, for our podcast, we always ask 9 questions that we call them the Nerd 9 because we like alliteration. And I feel bad.
Hate some of these.
I feel bad because you literally just got done saying, like, I can never think of my favorite such and such. So
right,
apologies in
okay,
advance.
That's fine. Yeah. We won't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can say whatever you want. We're not going to know any difference. So the first one is, what is the last book that you read?
The last book I read is, Whiskey Galore by Compton Mackenzie. It's an old kind of potboiler. It was a film. It's about this ship that sank off on the Western Isles of Scotland, and there's like 250,000 bottles of whiskey on it, and all the locals, and it was during the war when there was rations, so there was no whiskey on the island, so they all rowed out and grabbed all the whiskey. And then the excise man came to try and get, you know, the money for the duty on it all, and they hid them all. They like put them in, there's always whiskey in drains and whiskey buried, and now on the island of Harris, I think, no, Eriskay, it's Eriskay. Like, people, sometimes when they're digging their gardens, they find old bottles of whiskey that have been there for 50 years. I was actually doing a documentary about those islands, so I read the book to kind of get me in the mood.
That is amazing. Do you have a favorite place to read?
No, I don't really. I kind of like just always having a book in my bag, and just, I love reading on planes, I have to say, because that's sort of, nobody's going to interrupt you, though. Mm-hmm. If only interruption is someone to bring you a delicious glass of wine, some nuts, sure. And I like that.
I'm really excited to ask this next one. Do you have a guilty pleasure that you would mind sharing with us here? Knowing full well that you get it very personal in your show later tonight. But
Well, I actually don't think there should be any guilt around pleasure.
That's a perfect answer. Okay.
All right.
I know you've been all over the world, but do you have a place you'd love to travel that you haven't yet been to?
Yeah, I haven't really been to South America very much, and I'd really like to go there. I was supposed to a couple of times, and it all kind of fell through. So that's one of the places that I want to go. And also, I'm absolutely fixated on train journeys, and there's an amazing, well, there's the Trans-Siberian Express you can take from Russia, and it goes all the way to China, but there's now this other one from Vladivostok to Moscow that I'm obsessed with, because I love a train. Last week, I did 2 overnight train trips in Britain. What I do is, in order to beat jet lag when I go to Britain, I fly on the day flight to London, then get a cab to the train station, get the overnight sleeper to Scotland. So then you wake up and you've had a sleep on the plane, some sleep on the train, and you have a little whiskey and everything, and then you arrive and you're up early and you kind of, you know, it sort of
beats. That's a really good idea.
It takes a while longer, but I love a train.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite holiday?
Do you mean like a Halloween or Christmas or something?
Yeah.
Well, I like the idea of Thanksgiving in that it's not religious and it's people all come together. But I don't like that it's based on the, you know, genocide of an indigenous population.
Right. Yeah. Fair.
So, torn.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I kind of like Halloween because I love seeing everyone let go and dress up. But I don't really, I dress up enough myself.
Right.
So I don't really like that. If Thanksgiving had less evil beginnings, ooh, that would be my favorite.
Sure.
How about a favorite movie?
Oh, well, I think my favorite movie is Waiting for Guffman. It's Christopher. Because it's Christopher Guest's film. He made all those kind of mockumentaries, you know, but the one about the dogs called Best in Show and everything. And Waiting for Guffman's about a little town in Missouri that is putting on this show, a little kind of community show about the 150th anniversary of the town. And for some weird reason, they think that this man, Mr. Guffman's going to come, and they're going to go to Broadway with this show. And it's so hilarious and tender as well. And actually, when I saw it shortly after I came to live in America, and it really taught me a lot about American culture, because I thought, if that's being parodied, it must really exist, you know? So Waiting for Guffman was a very educational film for me as well. It's funny.
I feel like I know the answer to this one, but we ask it every time. Cats or dogs?
Oh, dogs.
Yeah. That's I'm
allergic to cats. Actually.
It's
I mean, not,
that's
I mean,
not
really,
understandable
not,
reason.
I really am allergic to it. I get my eyes go funny. And stuff.
So, I'm a dog person, Jill is a cat person, so this is like this is a small little battle we have. So every time someone says dog, I kind of have like a little excitement in me. Favorite food?
I like spicy things. I'm vegan, so it's kind of like, you know, I once went on, there's a TV show in Britain where you sort of, it's a Saturday morning cooking thing, and you go on and you are interviewed whilst they're doing things, and you have to say your food heaven and your food hell, and then the audience votes to see whether or not you've got to. My food hell was, how do you say it in America, lychees, is that what you say? Lychees, those little fruit, those little, lychees, yes, we say lychees. And I just find them, like, I want to gag just even thinking about them. So there was a thing where my heaven was like spicy potato croquettes or something, and my hell was that. And I had to sort of make a plea to the British public not to make me eat lychees.
Oh, God.
I know, but I said, really, I will vomit if you do that. And that might have been more spur for them, but yeah. But I like spicy, you know, like Asian-y things.
Mm-hmm. And then the last one, if you could have dinner with anyone in the world, alive or dead, who would you pick?
Actually, I'd love to have dinner with Donald Trump. I really would. I would.
I'd love to watch you having dinner with Donald Trump.
You should sell tickets.
I would be fascinated just to be that close to him. Actually, I have been that close to him. I sat next to him at a thing once, and I think I'm fascinated by him, and horrified as well, obviously, but. I think it's good to kind of meet the people that you. I think we're all trying to figure him out. I think he's trying to figure himself out. So I think that would be a fascinating dinner companion.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, we have a million more questions, but let's let you guys ask some questions. If you have a question, if you want to just stand up, we'll kind of call you out, and then we'll repeat the questions so people can hear. Right here in the front. Sure. So the question, the questions were, what were the politics for you not getting a Tony for your performance in Macbeth? I want to make sure I get that whole thing accurate.
Yeah.
Well, this is a production I did actually first of all in Scotland for the National Theatre of Scotland, and then we did it the next year on Broadway. And it was a crazy production where basically I played all the parts in Macbeth, and it was incredible, you know, it was incredibly challenging. It was the most challenging I've ever done. I thought I was going to die. And it was a really kind of... It wasn't a very, very unusual thing. And what was really great about it was that, A, I lived, but, B, we found an audience on Broadway for such a weird kind of, you know, European-y style concept. And an audience of young people. And that really excited me. But I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why I didn't get nominated for Tony. I have heard that it's because not enough of the nominee committee had seen the show. That's what I heard. It's a tragedy, I know. But you know, it's like one of these things when you're... It's a really weird situation because awards are this double-edged sword. Of course, everybody wants to be patted on the back. It's nice. But like if you're, you know, like you see all this list going, absolute shoo-ins for nomination, Alan Cumming, blah, 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 blah. And everyone says that you think you're going to be nominated, or indeed also if you're nominated, they think you're going to win, that if you don't get nominated, and this happened with Macbeth because everyone did think I was going to get nominated, including myself, I have to say, then you get all this pity. You get like real, like pity, everyone's, and you get pity presents, which is quite good. That's a good. But when you say you're at the, you know, was at the Golden Globes or something earlier this year, and I knew I wasn't going to win, but it's just, you know, you're there's a chance you might. There's a 1 in 5 chance. And then when it's not your name, you're like, okay, great. So where's the bar? And and you see all people going like. Sad face, you know. So I think, you know, it's like reviews. Awards and everything are like reviews. If you believe the good ones, you have to believe the bad ones. And I think it's obviously it's lovely to be lauded and to be told that people like you and appreciate your work. But it's not why I do it. And I you know, it was actually a very interesting experience when that happened because it reinforced me, like what was important to me was doing that play and reaching an audience that I was really excited were coming to a Broadway theatre. Thank you.
In the blue with the scarf? Yeah. So the question is, what did you enjoy about your role on The Good Wife and doing TV in general?
Well, first of all, what it was a really great experience for me. It was like, you know, 6 years I worked on it for 9 months of every year, and it was a really it really sort of made me very stable, and I, you know, had structure in my life that previously hadn't been there, and I was able to be at home in New York for at least 9 months of the year, which had never happened before. I was always, you know, jetting around the world, which sounds lovely and it is lovely, but you know, it gets a little old when you just want to be at home. So it gave me a great sense of stability in terms of my home life, and also financially. You know, it was just nice to have a regular paycheck, and also it kind of grew up a little bit. I mean, I'm a middle-aged man, and I can play people who are real middle-aged men in suits. Because when I first did it, when I was first cast, it, nobody could believe they'd cast me. I'd never really played real people before. I mean, I'd hardly played, a lot of them weren't even humans I played, you know what I mean? So I always played kind of extreme people and kind of fantastical people. So the idea that I was playing, I think he's as crazy as, you know, a mutant, but nonetheless, it was a different thing for me. So in a way, I really appreciate it for that reason as well, that I feel I've grown up a little bit because of it, and in terms of how people perceive me, perhaps. But in terms of the character, I mean, it was a great thing to kind of come into a show that was, you know, it was in the middle of the first season, it was this big hit, and I kind of came in, and they had this great idea for a character, and I kind of, you know, it was a very interesting back and forth thing with the writers, that you do something, they kind of pick up on it, and I loved how crazy he was, you know, and just this, every time I think of him, I just kind of tense up. And as someone said, oh, you lost weight all during those years. I think that's probably because I was just so tense all the time playing Eli. And he was just a really fun character to play. And as it grew and went on, there was more facets of him. And I loved my relationship with his daughter. And, you know, and it was just a really, I look back on it with such fondness and a great bunch of people. And I've actually signed on to do another television show for CBS that, if it all goes well, if it's all, you know, the pilot's shot and they like it, we'll shoot it, start shooting again in next July, and it'll be on television in September, I presume. And I actually really do, I've realized I really enjoy that structure. It's kind of, I'm quite willing to dive back into it. It's been nice to have a little break from it and kind of be able to dash around a bit. But yeah, I like it.
The heart on your sweater?
Frankie.
Yeah. I was wondering, you know, not knowing much of your past, so who helped you out at the beginning, right? When you were in Alan Cumming,
So the question was, before you were Alan Cumming, who helped you out when you were just Alan?
Well, I mean, I went to drama school when I was 17. I had no back. I applied for one drama school. It was the only drama school I knew of in Scotland. There was only one. and then I had no backup plan. I trained for 3 years, and then I immediately just started working. And I've worked ever since. It's really boring. I know it's awful, but and annoying as well, because people. I know. In a funny way, I think it's quite interesting that people, kind of, if you're an actor, they kind of expect you. Sort of expected if you've struggled. And I haven't, and also, but I think a lot of that's to do with I've made a lot of my own work, like this book, like my show tonight. Like, I have done things like that, like the film that the gentleman talked about, you know, with Jennifer. I've written and made a lot of things myself, and so that kind of helps, you know, because you don't always have to rely on people doing things like that to you. But like, I suppose, you know, there's this guy. The very first theater thing I did was actually Macbeth. I played Malcolm in a proper production. It wasn't just a crazy person doing all the parts. And he's this director at he recently ran the Royal Shakespeare Company. He's called Michael Boyd. And I was a student at drama school, and I used to do this stand-up comedy thing with another boy called Victor and Barry, and we'd been doing those gong shows in the bar of this theatre, and we won the gong show, and then there was like the gong of gongs, and we had to come in, and we won that too. And so he saw me doing this crazy sort of campy double act, and then cast me to play a prince in Macbeth, and so I guess he gave me my first sort of break, and yeah, and that was, you know, it was like 75,000 years ago.
Is it black shirt? Yeah, go ahead, sir. Thank you.
Throughout your long and varied career, what's your greatest piece of advice you have for an upcoming performer?
So what would your piece of advice be for an up-and-coming performer?
I always say just try and be yourself. Try and resist the temptation and resist the pressure to become a type or a generic version of yourself. And actually embrace who you are and embrace your own experience, and because that is the most interesting thing about yourself. And I feel like, I always say to people, like, when you look at a screen, there's certain people you're more drawn to, you know? And I suppose that's what being a star is. It's people are fascinated by you. But I think the people that we are fascinated with are people who are allowing their own spirits to come through, and they're not kind of closing themselves off and being a sort of a generic type. So it's hard, and it's easy for me to say, but I think that's always the advice I give to young performers.
In the bright green. Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks
for coming.
My pleasure.
You have such a public life, and you've done so many things. You seem to live a really authentic life. What is your internal dialogue?
So the question is...
Right. Oh, yes, go ahead.
What is your internal dialogue like?
Right, now it's like, why did that lady ask me that question? do you mean, like, do I have, like, kind of, you know, anxious voices and things? I'm not quite sure what internal dialogue... I think I am authentic. You know, I think that's what... I do strive for that. And that's, actually, my show tonight is... an overall theme is about authenticity. And I feel that, again, like this, with that, what the question you asked about advice to a young performer, being authentic, I think, is what we all should be, and it's something I think to strive for as a human being as well as a performer. And I think I've found it's always stood me in good stead. You know, I think that the more I am my own man and open and speak out about things that I think need to be said. I think, I've noticed that doing my Sappy Song show, I go to places in the world where, you know, and I, with audiences that I know probably don't agree with my politics or even agree with my rights as a queer person, actually. But I find if you are open and honest and authentic, they'll probably respect you for that more than if you were someone who agreed with their politics. So it's a really interesting lesson to learn that that's, you know, that kind of trumps. ill will. So I don't really know what my internal dialogue is. It's probably just like, you know, when did I last take my vitamins and stuff like that. Sorry, it's not a very good answer. Sorry.
In the maroon right here in the middle? Yes.
Hi.
So what did you give Eli and what did Eli give back to you as a character?
I think one of the things why Eli was so sort of popular was that people could, there was a sort of, it's almost a Brechtian thing. It was almost like people knew it was me playing Eli. Do you know what I mean? There was a sort of thing that it was quite fun to see what I was going to do with this person. And so in a way, and I think people, you know, knew that I was very different to him. So there's kind of an interesting, I'm quite intrigued by that. That also happened, the lady mentioned Macbeth. When I did Macbeth, I really noticed that people were worried for me, Alan, as well as the character in this very violent sort of situation I was in. But I gave Eli probably a sense of quirkiness and a sense of humor that might not have been there originally. And what he gave me was sort of maybe more a bit of tension and kind of, you know, an ulcer or something. But I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I also felt like, you know, I'd arrive on set, and sometimes, like in the summer, when I'd be at these, I would go to these sort of beach parties, we'd have all funny costumes and everything, and I'd come back in on Monday, and the makeup lady would be like, "There is glitter on your cheek." Sorry. And I'd go in do rehearsal in my, like, you know, Uggs and whatever, and flip flops or whatever, and then you know, and an old T-shirt, and come down all, you know, I said it was like getting into Eli drag. When I put on my suit and get my hair all done, and sometimes people wouldn't recognize me, some of the crew, and sometimes we'd have to stop filming because, like, if I would turn around and say something and say, "We see a bit of glitter on Eli's eyes," and then in the season six, the penultimate season, that was when I was doing Cabaret again as well, and so I see clips of, I've got loads of eyeliner on from the night before. I've got more eyeliner than Alicia, actually, in some of the scenes.
The gentleman in the blue on the end?
Go ahead, Jill.
You can repeat that question? Or?
You can repeat that question. Oh,
well, maybe it will become apparent in my answer. I think theatre has always been a platform for questioning social change, politics. That's what it's for. It's, you know, it's a place that people come together, yes, to be entertained, but also to be informed and challenged. And, you know, I thought it was interesting when, again, to, you know, go back to our president-elect, when this whole thing with when the vice president-elect was booed and they did the speech at the end of Hamilton, and the president said, you know, the theatre is a safe place, it should be a safe place, and blah, blah. I thought, absolutely not, it's not a safe place. It should be a vital, dangerous place. Anything could happen in the theatre, you know, and that's why we come. It's exciting. It's not safe. I don't think safety is what I would think of. I mean, I like going into the building and feeling at home there, but it's because I feel that I can express myself, and you know, it's a place of ideas and it's a place of challenge. So I think that's always been the case, and I think especially now, you know, it's always interesting when there's a more right-wing government, you see a rise in satire, performance and writing, and I'm sure, you know, one of the positive things about President Trump will be that a really fecund time for writing and protest in this country. But so I feel like I have a responsibility as an actor, as a writer, to speak out, and as a celebrity as well. I think this idea that celebrities should not say anything is really why? They have opinions. They are citizens. They have, you know. And if you have a platform, there's a reason for that. If people want to ask you about, you know, what color your hair is, I think then they should at least listen to you about your politics. So I don't adhere to this idea that being famous is equals silence, especially when if you're an actor and you've been an actor from the theatre where you are embodying ideas and embodying challenge and asking the audience to, I mean, you're a vessel for social change, I think. So I do feel a responsibility for that. I think very much so in the plays that I do, to do a play, I have to be really challenged, and it's a big commitment. And I try and with all the material I try and kind of find something that excites me and I feel has some good. And sometimes I just do things for the money. But in the theatre, I always try and make sure that what I'm doing has some relevance and some social impact. And I think that's what my job is. I mean, that's why I say I'm a provocateur, because I think I don't want to just be an entertainer. Even tonight, you know, it's just me singing songs and telling stories. But I feel I'm challenging people and, you know, maybe making them think again about some things.
Here.
Hi. So I also got to see you in Macbeth, and it was stunning, and it's very clear that you're at home in the Shakespearean world, Macbeth or Hamlet or Saturninus, and so I'm wondering if you had to equate Donald Trump to a Shakespearean character.
Oh, wow.
Clown, king, horse, or otherwise, who would be?
Gosh, that's an interesting. Oh, you can say that.
Which Shakespearean character would Donald Trump be? It's a weird sentence to even say. Well, that's a very good point.
I haven't actually, you know, given this much thought. I was going to say Iago, but he's not clever enough to that. I mean, maybe one of the sort of kind of those drunk people in Twelfth Night. What do you call them? I don't know, actually. I don't know this yet. Even Shakespeare hasn't managed to encompass Donald Trump into a role. I mean, I guess it would be like a sort of someone... I mean, what I think is interesting about he's someone who needs approbation and needs power and needs to feel that he is the winner. And so I'm sure there's probably characters in Shakespeare like this. But of course, it's because he doesn't feel very good about himself, I think. You know, I don't think he wanted to win. I think I actually know from someone that, you know, knows him, he's absolutely gobsmacked right now that he won. He couldn't believe he even got the nominations. And I agree. But I don't think in a way, I think he wants to win. I think he needs to. And that's why I think actually right now is probably the safest time. And because he's won, he's the big guy, he's the top, you know, psychologically, he's in a safe place for a while. It's in, and then he's not against the wall being attacked. So, but I think perhaps if the character would be someone who is, you know, really, really wants power and wants fame and success for its own sake and not for, it's an empty shell, I think. I don't know quite who that would be in Shakespeare, but I'm sure there must be someone.
One more.
Yeah, down here in front.
Malvolio. Oh, that's the one from, yes, that's the one from Twelfth Night, yeah. So I was adored once, too. That's his great line.
So I wanted to say, you were awesome on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I'm sorry you lost, but you were amazing.
You have to bring that up.
You handled it beautifully.
Thank you.
I'm curious about your process of releasing your natural voice and working with American accent or different accents. Do you have a process for that, or do you listen to tapes? How do you find your voice?
So, how do you find your voice, whether it's with accents or your natural one?
Well, it's not as hard as everyone thinks, I have to say. I think actually the fact that I sound like this, and yet people have seen me so often playing an American person, and they think that's much harder. It's not that difficult, partly because I grew up in a country that is bombarded with American culture. Like 95% of the films and cinemas are American voices in them. A huge percentage of television, probably more than, you know, we hear British voices actually. Maybe not. But, you know, and that doesn't work the same way, but we get, you know, Downton Abbey once in a while, and that's kind of it. So so what I mean is I grew up hearing those sounds, and I grew up, you know, most people in Scotland can do a passable American accent, you know, so it's not that big a leap. And also I think as an actor, I was told in Scotland, you know, I went to this place called the Royal Scottish Academy, and I was told that I wasn't going to work as an actor sounding like me, and I had to learn, you know, sort of English received pronunciation. So that was kind of, I think a generational thing. That's not the case now, that I think, you know, people do much more speak with their own voices in Britain. But it set me off on a track of being very, very conscious about accent and listening and having a good ear for things. So I've always done a lot of different accents. I mean, for an American one now, I don't have a coach, unless it's somewhere difficult. Like I did a film in Minnesota, 10 years ago, and I had a did we lose someone? Because I mentioned Minnesota, sent someone lying. And I had an accent coach for that. That's a really beautiful film, actually, called Sweetland, if you get a chance to see it. I love it. And then the final thing you said about my process, I find the word process very difficult, and I will say I'm not a cheese, I have no process. Because I just think with acting and everything, you should just make it, you should not try and overcomplicate it. You know, when I'm playing an American person, I just do an American accent and just try and inhabit that person and just mean it and not have too much of a process that kind of gets in the way of just, you know, I think acting should be like kids playing. It should just be they completely inhabit a character and pretend to be in a situation. And that's really how I came to acting, was just making up stories to amuse myself. And I think there's been, especially in this country, there's a lot of time and money wasted with all these, you know, methods and processes and things. And I just think the world would be a better place if everything was a bit simpler.
So I know that your time is very valuable and you have to run here, so you won't be able to stay and do some signings and things. Anyone who's
signed every single book.
Well, the signings, four people, we saw that.
We watched it, yeah.
Yes.
Amendment.
You won't be able to. On Instagram after
everyone
this.
Here won't be able to watch you sign the book. But anyone who has read your book or follows you on social media knows that you are basically, I'm going to say, you're the inventor of the selfie. So we had an idea that we could get everyone if we could maybe just do a quick selfie here with the crowd behind us.
Give me a phone.
That's perfect. And we'll just tag each and every one of you. Yeah. It'll be great.
It'll be great.
Now, okay, so let me think.
So got
I have to go
one.
Here. I think you might have to go.
Yeah, you're going
to
be the one they want to see anyway.
Need to go down. You need to go down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm going down the stairs.
That's good.
Just.
I don't want to, get in front of anybody.
Adam, go over, see a bit.
This way.
Right, left.
That's good.
Okay, so we've got the majority of you. Ready? One, two, three, smile.
Nailed it. Thank Alan Cumming, everybody.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from Overdrive.com, and our library friends can add these titles to their collections and marketplace.
Hello, everyone. My name is Matt Neglia, and I am the host of the Next Best Picture podcast, part of the Film Entertainment Awards website, nextbestpicture.com. On our show, we explore all year long what is possibly going to win Best Picture at the Oscars. We do this by conducting interviews with people within the film industry, holding weekly reviews of the latest theatrical releases, and on our main show, where we dive into various different topics, answer your fan questions, and also do our best to explore Oscar history's past in hopes that it will tell us something new for this upcoming award season race. We hope that you will join us on all of the various podcasting networks. We look forward to seeing you over at nextbestpicture.com.